And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm delighted to welcome Amy Stewart back to the program today. She's had several hit nonfiction books about the natural world, including The Drunken Botanist. Recently, she's turned her attention to novels with a series of books based on the true life exploits of one of America's first women deputy sheriffs, Constance Kopp, as well as her sisters, Norma and Florette. The first book was Girl Waits with Gun, followed by Lady Kopp Makes Trouble, Ms. Kopp's Midnight Confessions, and today we'll talk about the fourth installment, Ms. Kopp Just Won't Quit. Amy, we last spoke about the first book in your Kopp sister series, Girl Waits with Gun, set in 1914, and now with book four, it's a couple years later in the series, and she's been working as a deputy for the Bergen County, New Jersey Sheriff's Office. What has her tenure been like?
You know, it was rocky. What strikes me about Constance's career is that she kept doing extraordinary things by the standards of women in law enforcement at that time. So she would chase down a fugitive and put the handcuffs on him. And, you know, she would do all the same things that men were doing. But when she did it, it made newspaper headlines nationwide. And that was kind of a mixed bag. As her star rose, I think it got harder and harder for the sheriff's department to deal with the publicity. And they got a lot of backlash from it. So there was a lot of, why do you have a woman doing this job? Kind of pushback for everything she did.
Because her story made it on the wires and across the country, it seems.
Yeah. You know, this is the era of the 1910s. This is at a time when every small town had not one, but probably two or three competing newspapers. And they had to fill all that space. So a story about a woman doing anything unusual was kind of a novelty type of story. And people would pick it up off the wire. So sometimes when I'm doing research and trying to figure out what she was up to, I don't find the story in the New Jersey papers. I find it in the El Paso paper that just happens to be the paper that survived and has a good archive. Yeah.
Well, and it was the time of the suffragettes. I mean, we're just a couple of years before the passage of the 19th Amendment.
Right. So the suffrage movement was in full swing, and so there was kind of a lot of coverage of women doing new and groundbreaking and unusual things. I even found a newspaper article about two women who went out and ran a race, just a foot race. They just ran really fast, and that made the papers. Like, that was so weird that women were going to go outside and run fast.
Well, I think it's weird when men do it, too. So. To show things haven't changed that much, she got marriage proposals from afar from lonely hearts men.
Yes, she did. I know. And in this way, you know, I sort of think about newspapers as in some ways like the Twitter of today as well. There were all these little inconsequential bits of news, and that same kind of response would happen. Yeah, there were a couple of big profiles of her in the paper that were sort of full page with photos and illustrations, because newspapers were illustrated a lot in those days. And in response to those, marriage proposals would come in. I loved that idea. I mean, of course, she's horrified by it and she doesn't want anything to do with it. So I kept thinking about, like, what would those letters have been like? Like, how would they have read? And fortunately, I could find in newspapers of the day other marriage proposals that had been sent by mail, because this was kind of a common thing to do back then. It was sort of the match.com of the day. So I had actual wording of other men writing to women they'd never met and saying, why don't you move out here and marry me and I'll run the ranch and you can cook and clean. And so I used that wording for fictionalizing what those marriage proposals must have been like.
Ms. Kopp Just Won't Quit opens with a newspaper item from 1916, and Sheriff Heath calls her the finest law enforcement officer in the entire state of New Jersey.
Yes. You know, Sheriff Heath took a lot of flack for hiring her. It was not a popular decision. Women were moving slowly, very slowly, into law enforcement, and mostly they had to really force their way in. In other words, they'd have to go before the city council and embarrass the mayor and the police chief into hiring at least one woman. And it was usually a question of decency. It was, you have these women locked up in a jail cell, and the only person with a key to the cell is a man. We can't have that. So with great reluctance, police chiefs and sheriffs were letting maybe one woman in. But Sheriff Heath, it was his idea. He initiated it. He offered her the job. He really went out on a limb and defended her over and over again and made it clear that she was doing absolutely as fine a job as any of his male deputies were. So it was quite remarkable. He went well beyond just accepting the fact that he probably should have a deputy and really advocating for her. And the more she got criticized, the more he dug in and said, like you said, you know, she's one of the finest detectives in the state. He was very, very much on her side.
She's also not just acting as a matron at the county jail. Mm-hmm. She is out enforcing the law, arresting ne'er-do-wells, male and female. In the beginning of the book, she's chasing after a suspect in a robbery. And as any policeman would do, she put her purse under her arm and gathered up her skirts and took chase.
Right. Yeah, right. She stumbles across a shoplifting incident, and the guy's just running out of the butcher shop and has grabbed some stuff. So she has no choice. She's got to run after him. You know, it's happening right in front of her. And I think a lot about what it must have been like to do that job wearing the clothes she wore. Picture women of the 1910s, and it's a long skirt that goes almost to the floor, and it's petticoats and corsets and a big hat and high lace boots and gloves, and it's the whole deal. But she has to be able to run fast and tackle people and throw them down to the ground and do all of that wearing the clothes of the day. And, you know, the funny thing about that is I've gotten real interested in the history of police women. And I have photographs of women working for the LAPD as recently as like the 50s and 60s, where they're still wearing a skirt and stockings and high heels and little white gloves. Like, they're so clearly put into clothes that say, you're not going to do a man's job. You can walk around and write parking tickets on the sidewalk, but that's as far as it goes. So, yeah, that was really a thing.
I can't remember the Angie Dickinson show from the 70s, Policewoman. Did she wear trousers all through that?
That's interesting. I should go back and watch that. I don't remember. Huh.
At this particular butcher shop, she was going for lunch because on Tuesdays they had this fabulous sausage.
Yes.
That the butcher made. Was there really such a sausage in that area that you found in your research that people would have gone nuts for like that?
No, that's fiction. One of the things about Constance that I really like is she loves to eat. And I'm a vegetarian and she is not. So I'm always sort of looking for, well, what is something of the time that she would have really loved and found irresistible? So the way that I come up with a story like that is I go through the newspapers of the time and I'm careful to stay in the kind of New Jersey, New York area because food was so regional at that time. And just to find some story of some, so, you know, I found another story of an Italian butcher who had this specialty. And I was like, okay, well, we're going to have her be sort of addicted to this particular thing.
Back at home, the stores are getting a little low because she's working so much, having to spend overnights at the jail mm-hmm. in her matron duties. Her sister, Florette, is working. And Norma, her other sister, is not particularly domestic in her way. So they are relying on the largesse of her brother and his wife, who she's much nicer than he is, it seems.
Right. Yeah. You know, I tried to think about, here are these three more or less adult women. I mean, Florette's the youngest, and she's maybe 18 by this time. But so let's say three adult women living by themselves and trying to be working women. And even though they didn't have children or a husband to take care of, housework was incredibly difficult and time-consuming at that time. There were no microwave ovens. There were no washers and dryers.
There's a reason they call them modern conveniences.
Yes. So everything took forever. So, yeah, with both Constance and Florette out working, it falls to Norma to kind of run the household as best she can. Yeah, so their brother lives not too far away, and his wife is a wonderful cook and always is sort of whipping up extras and dropping a little, you know, a casserole off or some jars of chicken soup or something like that, just to sort of keep them going.
And Florette and Norma kind of have a bit of conflict about picking her up at the station when she gets back from her job. They butt heads about that.
Yeah, right. This is another thing that is so different for the 1910s. A lot of people didn't have cars. The cops in real life were still dependent on horse and buggy. So if you lived out in the countryside, it was tough for you to get anywhere. And I'm always thinking about that. I'm always thinking, well, how does Constance get there? Like, does she walk? There were all these little streetcars that were almost just privately run little affairs. People would start one up and it would run for a year or so between one place and another, and then it would go by the wayside. And so with Florette, What she's doing, and this is fiction, but very much based on real life, is that she's taking the train down to Fort Lee, New Jersey, where the movie industry has just started. Thomas Edison was in Fort Lee. And so before it went to Hollywood, that's where it was all happening. And she's sort of connected with a vaudeville actress who's trying not very successfully to transition from the stage into the theater. So that's a long commute. She can't possibly do it every day. And it's a long walk or horse and buggy ride from the train station in town out to the farm where they lived. Yeah, you can imagine. You can't text somebody and say, hey, my train's running late, or hey, I miss my train. So somebody shows up to wait for you. And if you're not there, then they're just sitting around for an hour or two with nothing to do. So, yeah, that was a constant source of conflict between Norma, who's very rules-driven, very much wants everything planned out and predictable and wants things to go the way she wants them to go, and Florette, who's more flighty and also very self-involved and not particularly concerned with, you know, inconveniencing Norma is not a big problem in her mind. So it's one of the many things they butt heads about.
Norma is more of a homebody, but she has a very strong interest in homing pigeons.
Yes.
And she thinks she can help the coming war effort.
Yes. This is fiction. This is something I invented to keep Norma busy because I don't in real life know what Norma was doing. But I do know that Norma was kind of this difficult, disagreeable person, that she was in real life very judgmental and could hold a grudge forever. So a lot of her personality actually came from me talking to family members. But the thing with the pigeons is that pigeon keepers at this time really were gearing up to help with the war effort. You know, the army didn't have a robust communications department already built out ahead of World War I. They really had to scramble. So this is the Army Signal Corps that I'm talking about. They handled wireless, telephone, Morse code, semaphores, waving flags around, the whole bit. And really, when we got into World War I, they had to borrow the communication manuals from the British and the French because they just didn't have anything. So yes, America's pigeon keepers were well ahead of all this and were already working out best practices and running tests to see how long pigeons could fly and how high up in the air. And they were, in real life, working on building these carts that would transport pigeons to the front so that soldiers could send messages back to headquarters from the trenches. And hopefully the pigeons would fly high enough and fast enough to avoid German gunfire. So this is something that was already happening in Europe. Americans weren't yet in the war, but American pigeon keepers were very much working on this. So much so, they even, in real life, they did this project where they sent pigeons to the White House to deliver messages to President Wilson about the importance of pigeon communication in the war.
We talked the last time about the first book, about the coming of modernity, the crash of modernity coming this way. And it just seems like pigeons and trench warfare, that was like the last gasp of the previous century.
It really was. Yeah, it's such an interesting period of time. And I'm actually going to be kind of sad to be out of that period of time and to get into the 1920s, because I'm fascinated with the idea that 100 years ago, literally 100 years ago from right now, life was so different. You know, one of the things that struck American soldiers when they got over to France is how much of France was still so rural, and people were really living like peasants still, very much living like they had for hundreds of years, with no electricity or maybe even gas, no modern plumbing. One of the things that American troops had to do was install all of that as soon as they showed up in a village. So yeah, it's interesting that 100 years ago seems in some ways so recent, but in some ways life was so very different.
Now, I was a little taken aback when she nabbed the shoplifter and she took him back to apologize to the butcher. The butcher said he was a Pole in a very derisive way.
Yes.
He's Polish. And I just thought it was interesting to show marginalized communities can still have their own prejudiced ways of thinking as well.
Oh, yes. Right. I wish I had more opportunities to get into that in this book. I sort of take every opportunity I can to explore the way that immigrants were treated, the way they treated each other, all the stereotypes. So at that time in Paterson, Hackensack, New Jersey, that area, while it was a very white community, it was an immigrant community. So the marginalized people may have been white, but they were, you know, they were Polish, they were Irish, they were Spanish, Turkish, Italian. And all of those groups were looked down upon. They all had their own insults and stereotypes. And yeah, in some cases, you know, pushed back at each other. A lot of times it was a question of, are you newly arrived or have you been here for a couple generations? So all of that was going on. There was a tremendous amount of kind of simmering animosity among and between all of those groups right then.
A current theme for sociologists to look back and when the concept of white came into being, because before it was just all these different European ethnicities.
Right. This moment in time, too, the 1910s, is really when Americans, whoever, people who were already here, started saying, you know, these immigrants are coming and they don't want to learn our ways. They don't want to speak our language. They're peasants. They're bringing their peasant practices over here and wanting to live in cities and work in factories. Maybe what we ought to do is round them all up and ship them out west, and they can live on farms and sleep in the barn like they're used to. Like, this was in the papers. This is what people said. So, yeah, it's amazing to think about that and think about where we are today and where we were then.
Now, she does head back to the county jail. As we mentioned, she has the job of matron as well at the jail. Who are some of the charges she has at the time?
Yeah, so her job was to oversee the women, and in some cases children. I don't really have any children in there right now, but to oversee the women and children who came through the jail. And one of them, for instance, is a character that we've seen before because she's serving a little bit longer term. Her name is Providencia Manafo.
And
she's,
what a character she is.
Yeah, she's great. And she's real, too. She really did shoot her tenant. She was running a boarding house, and she shot and killed her tenant. And for that, she went to jail. But there were some questionable things about that case, and I had to fictionalize it a little bit. But my version of the story is that she was really aiming for her horrible, abusive husband and only accidentally shot the tenant, who just happened to be standing in the wrong place at the wrong time. So she's the only inmate that they'd ever had at the jail who very much wanted to admit her guilt and stay in jail because she was terrified of her husband. And the reason this story interested me is that I used to work in a battered women's shelter. We didn't have those in the 1910s. That's a new thing since about the 1970s, that women who were a victim of domestic violence had anywhere to go at all. So what Constance and Sheriff Heath are doing by sort of saying, you know what, she's guilty, let's leave it at that. Let's let her serve out her sentence here in the county jail rather than going to a state facility. That was all kind of a very early recognition of domestic violence. Now, you notice they didn't try to go after the husband on domestic violence charges. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have entered into anyone's way of thinking. But at least they're doing that.
Now, there is also another guest of the state
at
the jail whose family had decamped for Portland, Oregon. And that's something you've done recently, too.
Yeah, I have decamped for Portland, Oregon, although I have to say that story is also true. It didn't happen in Constance's jail, but this is one way that I populate the women's floor of the jail, is that I go look for other women who have been arrested somewhere in that region at that time period, and I put them in her jail. So at least I'm dealing with real crimes. And it's funny, too, because it's another example of how we just didn't have good court system for this. So it was really a custody case. And in those days, if parents got divorced, the father usually kept the child. It was the opposite of how it is now. So the mother went off to Portland, Oregon, and the father had the child, and the grandmother didn't feel that he should be the one raising this child and that he was perhaps not safe and wanted to kidnap the little grandchild and get her out to Portland without anybody knowing about it. But the father raised a fuss, and she ended up in jail for that.
Now, how are you enjoying Portland?
Oh, I love Portland. I'm very glad to be in a city. I've been living in a small town for 17 years, and I was ready for sort of the pleasures of the big city again, and Portland is it.
But y'all have hung on to your bookstore, right?
Yes. We own a bookstore in Eureka, California, which is about an eight-hour drive from where we are in Portland. So we like to say that it's an independent bookstore, and it's so independent that it lives in California and we live in Oregon.
Is Eureka like a timber area, timber logging area?
It was at one time, yeah. I mean, there's less and less of that. But yes, that's kind of how it got its start.
Sheriff Heath is getting ready to be not Sheriff Heath.
Mm-hmm.
Because New Jersey law at the time said a sheriff couldn't serve consecutive terms in office. So what are his plans for the future?
Well, he, in real life, ran for Congress. That meant that Constance was going to have a new boss either way. So fortunately, the wonderful thing about writing a novel about an election is that it's in the newspaper every day. So I know a lot about the different people and who was running, and I can read the campaign speeches because, as you can imagine, the local paper covered that breathlessly. Like, they loved having, you know, that kind of a story.
Lots of column inches right there.
Lots of column inches, exactly. Sheriff Heath was a Democrat, and so there was the Democrat candidate for sheriff is someone who had been sheriff years before, and he's kind of an older generation. He doesn't quite understand this idea of women working in a jail, but he's, you know, maybe that'll work out okay. And the guy running on the other side is the county prosecutor, John Corder, who in real life was very much locking horns with Sheriff Heath all the time and hated Constance and hated the idea of a woman working in the jail. So that's what she's dealing with. And while that election is sort of just going on in the background, everything she does and every time she gets in the paper, now it's fodder for the election cycle news coverage.
The way you kind of describe Corder's style, at least in the book, seems very reminiscent of recent politicians, it seems.
Oh, does it? Well, I got to tell you, I sit down to write a new book in November is when I start writing. I have a rule. It's maybe 1,000 words a day or something like that every day until I get a first draft done. So that takes me about 3 months. So I stay home over the winter to do that. So I always know going into November what the book is about generally, because it's based on real events. So, of course, I know that, but I have a lot to figure out as I go once I start writing. Well, in 2016, it just so happened that the first day I had free to sit down and start working on my new book was the day after the election. November 9th, 2016 was going to be the day I started. So I woke up on November 9th, 2016, maybe to a world that I had not quite been expecting. And over the course of that winter, as I was digesting the events of the 2016 election, I kept seeing parallels with the 1916 election season on a national scale, but even on a micro level, that little dynamic between Constance and how she kind of got beaten up in the campaign cycle, even though she wasn't running. And so I leaned on some of those notes a little more in writing that book.
What was Wilson's reelection campaign of 1916 like?
He was very much trying to keep us out of the war, trying not to make that, you know, he didn't want to talk about it, and he kind of wanted to sweep it under the rug. And same with women's suffrage, which was starting to become a big issue in national elections because everybody campaigning was trying to figure out, if we come down on the side of this, does that ultimately help our side or does it work against us? And at that time, he was very much against women's suffrage. He said that it was such a new idea that he had not had time to adequately think about it. Now, go tell that to the suffragists who'd been fighting for this since the beginning of the abolitionist movement. So, yeah, it was an interesting and it was a very tight campaign. So there, you know, nobody knew for sure how it was going to turn out. But obviously he won.
He towed the line a little too much with the Southern Democrats and their approaches toward race.
Well, you know, here's something I didn't know about Wilson, is that Wilson was the last American president to have been raised by slaves, which is extraordinary to think about, the fact that he served in the 1910s.
Have you done much reading about how his wife ran the White House after his stroke?
A little bit, yes. Yeah, it was a very strange time inside the White House, for sure. I think it explains a lot about why we were so poorly prepared going into World War I. I mean, he was so reluctant to start gearing up for it, and it was really chaos, the run-up to it.
Now, back to Sheriff Heath's election for Congress.
Yeah.
He hasn't exactly been working very hard at it. His wife, Cordelia, on the other hand, and unlike the Cordelia in King Lear, is very ambitious. She really wants to advance her husband's career.
So my idea about Cordelia, and this is a real person I'm writing about, but I don't really know that much about her life. But my idea about Cordelia is that she probably didn't enjoy living at the jail. I think that's safe to assume for anybody. And that it was tough having a spouse in law enforcement, which, again, I think is a pretty safe assumption. So the idea that, oh, we're going to move to Washington and we're going to have a much more genteel and comfortable life would have appealed to her. And now she had a project. Now she had something to do that she could get engaged in and involved in that made her life better, which was important to her. And that's understandable. I mean, I think it's a reasonable position to take. So, yes, she's very engaged in the campaign. She has something to organize. She's sending Sheriff Heath off to speak at luncheons and gatherings, and she's making sure there's a nice portrait that's been taken of him and getting the stuff in the paper. And she's really embraced all of that. Of course, again, this is before we had, you know, professional campaign staff who knew how to do these things. So it's probably how a campaign would have been run. And yeah, Sheriff Heath, meanwhile, is a little too relaxed, a little overly confident that he's going to do just fine. So he's not working that hard. And he's also a little naive and idealistic in that he sort of feels like, I have a good reputation. I've done a good job. The voters know that. I'm on the right side of the issues. Why wouldn't they vote for me?
He doesn't know about fake news.
No, he doesn't. Although, you know, the funny thing reading newspaper coverage from 100 years ago is that we actually do have excellent journalistic standards today and modern methods of fact-checking and protocols and things that we do. And in those days, boy, things were really made up.
And so many papers were just party organs, essentially.
Making no attempt to hide it. So in Hackensack, you had the Bergen County Democrat and you had the, I think it was the Hackensack Republican was the name of the newspaper. So it wasn't even considered a bad thing, right? It wasn't anything to be ashamed of or hide behind. They were openly partisan newspapers and everyone knew that and they read the newspaper they wanted to read.
Deputy Kopp didn't really care much about politics, but her sister Norma had opinions on all the candidates.
Yes, I have Norma as an inveterate newspaper reader, you know, so she reads all 7 or 8 newspapers that are available within a, you know, 100-mile radius of where they live. And Norma's big on names and dates and people, and so she can rattle off, you know, if somebody did something terrible when they were elected county dog catcher 10 years ago, she remembers that and will hold that against them. So she's really an encyclopedia of all of this stuff and has a little more savvy view of the election because she is kind of a pessimist and she's a little bit grim and she likes finding fault with people. So she kind of sees through the nonsense and has some idea of how this is all really going to go down.
I did miss a device from the first book where she would send passive-aggressive newspaper headlines
right.
to her sister via pigeon.
I know. The reason she's not doing that in this book is that her sisters are so rarely home that they have now completely refused to participate in any of her pigeon stuff. So yes, her like what she's up to with those poor overworked pigeons sort of changes book by book, just depending on whether she has an audience for what she wants to do or not.
Let's get back to the business of law enforcement.
Yes.
And when she brings in the shoplifter back to the jail, the sheriff says he has another job for her, and it's to take a couple of people to the local asylum.
Mm-hmm. So there's a woman named Anna Kaiser who she was supposed to pick up and transport. It was the sheriff's job to take people to the asylum, or if they had to go somewhere else, a hospital, wherever an inmate had to be transported, or anyone within the county who had to go off to the asylum, the sheriff would do it. You know, in those days, if you were committed to an asylum, someone really did come and grab you and take you. It's not like you walked in of your own accord. So Constance had to go because it was a woman and women needed to be accompanied by other women. All I know about this case is that when Constance got to the woman's house, there was some trouble in getting her off to the asylum. That's pretty much all it said in the newspaper.
And that was the spark you needed.
That was the spark I needed. I thought, well, there'd be some trouble if you tried to take me off to an asylum too. But so what I did is what I do in all these situations is I did a lot of research about other women who were sent off to asylums at that time. And fortunately, there's some really good books that dive into the history of the 1910s.
It seemed such a simple, easy process back then too.
It was a pretty easy process. As you can imagine, mental health issues were very poorly understood. People got locked up for all kinds of reasons. And for women, postpartum depression could be a reason to get locked up. We did have a name for it. It was puerperal insanity is what it was called. But we didn't know what to do about it. Symptoms of menopause. Menopause wasn't mentioned at all in medical literature in the 1910s, as far as I could find. And so anyway, The story that I sort of concocted for Anna Kaiser is a combination of a few other real women's stories where she's going off having not been seen at all by a doctor this time. Essentially, her husband and the doctor who'd seen her in the past kind of got together with the judge and said it's time for her to go have a little time at Morris Plains, and off she goes. And so, yeah, she fights kicking and screaming because she thinks she's perfectly well, and she's in fact in the middle of cooking her husband's supper when Constance shows up to take her away.
And to have a man named Kaiser as the World War I is raging.
I know.
He didn't really have a shot, did he?
Yeah. Right. It's spelled a little differently. It's K-A-Y-S-E-R. But, you know, that was I use people's real names and their real stories as much as I have them. I even found this family in the census. And so the kids' names and all of that is real.
Well, and then Constance's last name being Cop, and she becomes a deputy sheriff.
Yes.
Nominative determinism at its best there.
Right. The newspapers had a field day with those little puns, as you can imagine.
Now, there was a man that she was supposed to help transport as well, and he made an attempt at an escape.
Yeah, there's two people in the car that night. They're going to the asylum. Someone else is driving. Constance wasn't driving. There was another deputy driving the car, and there was a male inmate as well. The weather was so bad that they ended up turning around and going back to the jail. Again, you have to remember, roads, we had cars, but we didn't have roads that were built for cars yet. So the roads were terrible. There were no streetlights. You'd get a flat tire just by looking at a tire wrong, it'd go flat. So they end up having to go back to the jail. And this other inmate runs off and runs into the river. And we don't know whether he was trying to drown himself or whether he was trying to escape and didn't even see that the river was right there or what the reason was. But again, this all really happened. Constance takes off after him. And she goes into the river in full garb. You can imagine like wool skirts and boots and hat and petticoat and all that stuff. And she jumps in there and saves him and drags him out. Now, there is no way that I could drag a full-size adult out of body of water. It shows you how physically strong she was. She was 6 feet tall, weighed 180 pounds, and she really had some strength and some power.
She's so, bigger than most men of the time.
She was, yes. The average height of a man was 5'7", 5'8", going into World War I. So yeah, she was bigger than everybody. So she drags him out. It's an amazing thing. It's incredibly brave. Sheriff Heath is understandably impressed that she pulled it off, either saved the man's life or kept him from escaping. And he wants to give her a medal. And this is something that was kind of a regular thing for sheriff's deputies. If they did something brave, he would go before the Board of Freeholders, which was like the Board of Supervisors, and they would be awarded a medal of commendation for their service. Constance is sort of like, you know, let's not make any more of it. It's an election season. Everything's a little weird. I was just doing my job. Let's not. And he's like, no. This is going to be great. We do this all the time. It'll once again demonstrate to the public what excellent people I have working for me. Of course, we're going to do this. And of course, it backfires, right? And it turns into a referendum on Sheriff Heath's poor judgment in having a woman there in the first place. And he's not capable of transporting inmates, and he's putting a woman in charge of unsafe, dangerous lunatics. He's soft on crime and blah, blah, blah. So it becomes a huge problem for him, and she doesn't get her medal.
It's just so unfair that politics is part of all of that.
Yes, right. Politics was inescapable in all this stuff. And part of it is, I'm sure, because sheriff is an elected office, as it is today everywhere, I think. I don't know anywhere where we don't elect our sheriffs. So politics does become a part of it.
It has been a while since you've been writing about the botanical world.
Yeah.
You've been having these wonderful novels come out. Has there been any recent plant facts you've stumbled across that you think you might want to share with the audience?
You know, I don't know. Not as much. Like I said, I just moved to Portland, Oregon, and I live right down the street from Washington Park, which is a 400-acre park in the middle of the city. It's absolutely dazzling. And I walk up into that park almost every day. And I realized as I started getting into that park that there was something new in bloom every time I went up there. And I thought, well, this is not by accident. I've been around botanical gardens. People work here and they think about this stuff and they make this happen. I have a little sketchbook and I've been sort of drawing and recording the changes in the park. So I've made that my little botanical art project. But I think that's probably of interest to nobody but me.
But I wanted to say that I was going to go back to when you talked about Twitter, and the old newspapers are kind of like Twitter today.
Yes.
But so much of social media now is under scrutiny, and people say it's bad for us and are very critical of it. But I'll have to say, whenever I see your sketches and your watercolors pop up on Facebook, it just makes me really happy.
Oh, thank you. I put them on Instagram and send them over to Facebook as well. Yeah, it is nice. One of the things I love about Instagram is I really only follow artists. So it's purely a feed of interesting artwork that people are making. And I have to say, that is a wonderful part about social media. That and keeping in touch with family and friends are the good things that have come from all that.
Does painting feed your writing, or is it just something to take a break from writing, or...
Yeah, it's such a wonderful break. It's really nice because, for one thing, it either gets me out in the world, so it gets me in the outdoors, or if I'm painting in my studio, I'm at least, you know, I'm standing up, I'm not looking at a computer screen, I can listen to music while I paint, which I really can't while I write. I love having art supplies, like I have actual stuff that I can interact with. I'm not just making, you know, letters appear on a screen. And I love that it's nonverbal. And I'm not having to figure out how to explain something or how to make something sound good. It's nice to do something that's with my hands that doesn't have words or language attached to it. So, yeah, it's wonderful that way. And I also love that you can learn things a lot faster making art than writing. Like, I can't honestly tell you that I've learned how to be a better writer. I don't feel that I have. I can't see any evidence of that. But with art, I can take a little class and I can learn how to do a thing. And then I can look at how I was doing it before I took that class and how I'm doing it after. And I can say, well, now I know how to do it, and it's better now. And I love that feeling of making measurable progress on something.
Would you share your Instagram handle with us?
Oh, sure. It's just Amy Stewart. It's my name. It's easy to find.
And I highly encourage everyone to check it out. They're
very lovely
paintings. Will there be another cop novel this time next year?
Oh, yes. I'm right in the middle of it. Yeah. So the fifth and the sixth book in the series will take place during World War I. So these are my war novels. And I only have one sentence about what any of the cops were doing during World War I. So I'm going to use that to the best of my ability. But the rest of it's going to be much more fiction than I've ever had to do before with these novels. And so what I'm doing, because I do love the research and I love the sense of this really happened and these were real people, I love that. So I am taking the cops and I'm putting them with real people and in real situations so that we can still, you know, explore some little world that maybe people have never heard of before. And you get a little bit of actual history out of that, even though I'm having to really take a guess about what they were up to.
So you have information about them after the war, and so you kind of just have to interpolate everything in between.
Right, right. After the war, their lives changed quite a bit. I do know what they were up to, so there will be more books after that, too. I hope, I think that's the plan. But it'll be quite different. And, you know, the 1920s, it's a different era for everybody. And that's one of the things that's kind of fascinating. Like, they're living through this particular era where, because they're women and they're going to be getting the vote, their whole lives change because of societal changes. They're very emblematic of their time, I think, in that way. So that's the fun thing about writing about them.
I have a sneaking suspicion that Norma's not going to like jazz.
No. Norma is going to have so much more to disapprove of in the 1920s. And Florette, you know, is going to get into all kinds of trouble.
She's going to have to be a flapper.
She is. You know, she's in her 20s during the 1920s. So she's really at the perfect age for everything that's coming.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for coming by again. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Thank you. This has been great.
Amy Stewart is the author of Miss Cop Just Won't Quit, the fourth installment of the Cop Sisters series, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.